Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Peaky Blinders is one offbeat and historic tale of organized crime. Netflix and the BBC introduced this series on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean 2 years ago. And next Tuesday, Netflix unfolds season 3 with at least 2 more seasons to come. Creator writer Stephen Knight joins me next from London in an internet radio exclusive. You know, you may look forward to less commercials or commercial breaks on some favorite channels this fall. Not only that, you may have the chance to interact with some commercials. Are we entering a new era of TV ads? We'll hear from VIA Media Chief Executive Mark Lieberman later this hour. And we've got an up segment on I Watch That, the project we showcased right here on last Friday's program that may get you viewing them. Also ahead, Chris Berman's ESPN Future, Red Nose Revenue, and our new classic trivia question winner. Yes, we do have a winner. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York on Block Talk Radio. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in the program. Happy to have you with us before you make your Memorial Day weekend move. 85 degrees at the top of the hour here in New York, and we welcome you to the program All About Television. As Steve Harvey would say, we got a good one for you this afternoon. Wonderful guests coming all over the place, and we invite you, as always, to be part of the program. It's so simple. Raise your voice. Use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number is good anywhere you're catching us across the country, all around the globe, right here on Blog Talk Radio. And if you don't want to raise your voice, you can raise your words to our chat room on blogtalkradio.com at SimonApple04 by name. And we've got guests far away than 444 already in the room. And as always, you can connect other people to the program by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen, follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. Stephen Knight of Peaky Blinders joins us live from London after these news notes. Can this fall be the final fall of Chris Berman's time at ESPN? Yes, according to a Sports Illustrated report released last night. The report discloses that Berman will bring his long run as host of Sunday and Monday Night NFL Countdown and NFL Draft coverage to an end after the 2017 Super Bowl. Sources also tell SI that ESPN could give Berman emeritus status beyond spring 2017, where he could do NFL playoff and Super Bowl coverage to some degree. ESPN is offering no response at this hour, but Berman's agent has contacted New York Times sports TV columnist Richard Sandomir, saying Berman will not retire or leave ESPN. Quote, loves what he's doing too much and is too young to hang him up, Sandomir told the agent via Twitter. NBC's second annual Red Nose Day raised more than $31.5 million. That's about $8 million more than last year. Some 70 celebrities participated in a two-hour special on NBC last night. Primary sponsor Walgreens donated $18 million to the total, based on Red Nose and Red Flare sales at their stores, along with customer donations. While dollars were up, viewing was down, about 2.5 million at the beginning to 1.7 million by the end. That's according to Nielsen. Red Nose funds will go to a number of charities assisting children nationwide and worldwide. You can still participate by going to these two websites: www.rednosedayusa.com or rednoseday.org. That's www.rednosedayusa.com or www.rednosedayusa.org. And that's news notes for today. Many of you may be under the impression that Netflix started its original programming lineup 4 years ago with House of Cards. Not true. The first original program that went on Netflix and streamed all over the world was a show called Lilyhammer from overseas with that famous assistant of Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, Stephen Van Zandt, in the lead role. And, of course, it turned out to be a big winner. And that led to House of Cards and Orange is the New Black and the rest is history. And along the way these last 4 years, Netflix has introduced us to some wonderful television from the BBC, other British sources, and other sources around the world. And one of the most popular is Peaky Blinders. It's actually based on a real-life situation, a post-World War II group of organized crimers and what they did. Peaky Blinders has been a big success on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. It started its third season on BBC earlier this month with some of its highest ratings ever, and on May 31st, next Tuesday, it goes back on Netflix for its third season. And 2 days ago, everyone involved with Peaky Blinders got some big news. BBC and Netflix renewed the show for 2 more 6-episode seasons. Joining us live from London, England, an internet radio exclusive, the creator and head writer of Peaky Blinders, Stephen Knight. Stephen, thanks for joining us. Your prime time, and congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a great few days. It's been wonderful. Really good.
Why do you think your series has caught on both sides of the Atlantic?
I don't know. I mean, it's about a family. It's about people living on the wrong side of the law, and it's about a sort of, I suppose you'd call it, an impossible masculinity. There is a culture just after the First World War in Britain, and I'm sure it's the same in big cities in the US, where people traumatized by war, men traumatized by war, came home and couldn't sort of accommodate the experiences that they'd had. And some of them drifted into crime. And this is a group of people, brothers, members of a family, who have been traumatized by the First World War. But in those days, no one showed their emotions. No one showed the damage. And they bottled it all up. And what you have really is a group of ticking time bombs who decide to use the things that they learned in the First World War to make a living. And they become illegal bookmakers and racketeers.
Mm-hmm. And this is a true situation post-World War II. How did this historical incident come your way? And when, at some point, once you learned about it, you said in your mind, this would make a good television drama?
Yeah, I mean, it's something, strangely, something I've wanted to do for so long, for 15, 20 years, because when I was a kid, these stories were told to me by my parents. My parents grew up in a very rough part of town in Birmingham, a big industrial town similar to, say, Pittsburgh or Detroit. And when they were kids, well, my mom was 8 or 9 years old. She was employed by illegal bookmakers to take bets because they used children because they wouldn't be arrested. So she would walk down a street barefoot with a basket full of washing, and people would drop a slip of paper with their code name on it, the name of the horse they were betting on, and some money into the basket, and she would then take that to the bookie. And my dad's uncles were a gang of illegal bookmakers called the Peaky Blinders. And so I heard these fascinating stories, and it's not written down anywhere. It's not a history that anybody ever bothered to write down. But for me as a kid, hearing these stories, it was just so compelling. And I knew that I had to tell it as a story one day for TV or film.
Did these figures have a Robin Hood mentality? What they were doing in illegal bookmaking, they were trying to, like, rob from the rich and give to the poor?
I would love to say that was the case, but I'm not sure that it was. I think that they were people who were making a living as best they could. And in fact, what happened was that they became almost representatives of these people in an area where no one had any money. They were incredibly well-dressed. They were impeccably turned out. They were very glamorous figures. They cared about how they looked. And so, of course, you know, they became mythologized amongst the people that were around them. And it's a very particular world. It's a very particular way of speaking and talking. And, you know, it's been good and bad, because it's meant that ultimately I write all of them, all of the episodes, all the way through, because you sort of have to have been brought up with that world in order to be able to express it, which is, it's hard work, but it's very, very fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. In putting Peaky Blinders together, how much of it is based on the actual history of this family, and what kind of historical liberties did you and your production team take to give the flavor to the show, give flavor to the characters?
I mean, I've found some very interesting things out about research and about the way that history is recorded and the way things really happen, because I was told stories, as I say, by my parents, and discovered when I did research and read whatever was around, was that they actually sanitized it quite a bit, and it was much rougher and more violent than they had said. However, there is a tendency in written history to find patterns and to impose order. I mean, this was a chaotic time. These were chaotic scenes, and what I've tried to do is try and maintain some of the oddness of the real world, the oddness of real history, because I find that far more interesting than when you sort of try to impose what history considers to be the cultural milieu of the time.
Tommy, who's the lead character, is somebody who fought in World War I, highly decorated mm-hmm. for what he did, and then he falls into the formation of this organized crime family. How did you frame the character of Tommy, played, I believe, by Julian Murphy?
Yeah, Killian it was perfect for this. He's very impenetrable. And what I got from talking to people and doing the research was that men who came back from the war in those days were pretty closed down. They'd shut down their emotions. They weren't available, which, of course, made them very attractive as well. But what I wanted was a character who is completely unavailable, who is his motives are very difficult to ascertain. He doesn't show emotions. But the great thing about Killian and about the character himself is that one always, I believe, thinks that he's a good man doing bad things for a good reason. That ultimately what he does is for the family, for the preservation of the family, in very difficult and sometimes impossible circumstances. So that's the sort of character. He's bullet hard, but actually his motives are good.
Does he feel just as motivation that by being part of this, that he is trying to benefit society in some way as opposed to just being a pure bad guy?
Well, what I want to do over the course of five seasons, six seasons, is to take a person who at the beginning is very nihilistic, who one suspects is self-interested or interested only in the welfare of his family. What I want to do is over these seasons, first of all, he has a kid, which changes everything because suddenly he's got a new priority. And that over season four, season five, he will begin to reflect upon the fact that the group of people he comes from, the society he comes from, can also benefit from his abilities. So bit by bit, he does become a philanthropist. And even if at first it's for his own self-interest, after a while, this person comes alive. And I do like to think of it as that, is that here is a person who comes back from the First World War dead inside. And that over this long period of time, and that's the great thing about long-form television, is that you have time to do this. Killian and I are very keen to make this happen, is that over a long, long period of time, we watch this human being come back to life. And by the end of it, hopefully, there you have a fully formed, what you would call, good man.
Stephen Knight is the creator and the writer of Peaky Blinders, the critically acclaimed drama of an organized crime mob post-World War I, going into its third season on Netflix this coming Tuesday. Netflix is available on smart TV sets and smart TV devices like Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Google Chromecast, etc., etc. And, of course, is currently playing on BBC2. Stephen joins us live this half hour from London, England. Interview exclusive coming your way right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon Applegab with you on the other side of Atlantic in Newark, New York. Happy to have you aboard. Want to welcome, by the way, in our chat room, guest 462, guest 480, 482, 459. If a question or comment, put in the room or give us a call, 646-652-2906. We're not with you on Monday because of Memorial Day weekend, but we will be with you 24 hours later on Tuesday. We'll wrap up the month with Michael Hahn. At one point, he was the creator of a network that was out to do something special for Asian Americans called Imagination TV. Now he's getting involved in the smart TV, smart device programming field with a company called Digital Media Rights, in which he serves as chief executive officer. Michael Hahn joins us as our lead guest. And then we'll have the senior editor of TechCrunch, Anthony Ha. He'll join us. He's a native New Yorker, native Brookline like yours truly. We'll talk about where smart TVs and smart TV devices go from here, virtual reality on a television set, interactive programming, and a whole lot more. Anthony Ha, senior writer and editor of TechCrunch, joins me live along with the rest of our crew. That's Tuesday, May 31st, same time as always, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. One great thing about British television is that most of the time, Stephen, there's one writer, one series, you write all the episodes. What's the benefit of doing that, of being in control of an entire set of shows from start to finish?
Yeah, I find it very fascinating that the way that there is a divide between the way things are done in Britain and things are done in the States. And I know in America, writers' room work incredibly well because of the fantastic stuff that comes out of the United States, and the television that comes out is second to none. I don't know. In Britain, it doesn't seem to work, but it does work on certain things. I think it's great for comedy in Britain, where you get a group of people who are contributing lines and ideas. But for me, particularly with Peaky Blinders, it didn't work and doesn't work. And so series two, series three, I've written all of them myself because I feel it gives you a cohesion, it gives you a sense of purpose, it gives you... You know what the destination is, and you know you know, if you've got the destination in mind, you know that the sort of tangents you can go on. You know that you can go rambling off in another direction for a little while, knowing you're going to come back. And for me, I wouldn't have it any other way, to be honest.
When you write, do you write all the episodes at once and then you put them on film, or do you, let's say, write half the episodes, 3 out of 6, then film them, or start filming the first 2 and then you go ahead and you see how things are looking and then you write the rest?
The first season was a little more chaotic as we were learning as we went along. And so I was still writing episode 6 when we were shooting the first block. It tends to be done in blocks of 2 sets of 3. But now for season 2, pretty much, and for definitely for season 3, everything was written before we started shooting. So it's mostly a financial thing, where if you know exactly what's going to be happening in all 6 episodes, you can make the most of whichever locations you've got without having to sort of think on your feet all the time. So we try to get it all completed before we start turning over.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take to find all the actors who make up the Peaky family, Jillian and everybody else? How long did it take, A, to find them, and then B, to bring them together to have them develop the chemistry that you and your producers wanted?
Well, we were very fortunate with Peaky, because I'd almost worked with Jillian on a feature about 12 months before we first did the first episode. And so we were in dialogue anyway. And then in that mysterious way that scripts find their way around various agents' offices, Killian had read it and came to us and said he was really keen to do it. And once we had him, it was sort of, the house of cards fell. We managed to get lots of people were interested. I think the key is to get the lead so that you're almost setting the tone. And then Sam Neill expressed an interest. So we weren't really going out after people. People were coming to us because, I don't know, there was a sort of a vibe about what this thing was going to be even before we started shooting it, and a lot of people were attracted to it.
Mm-hmm. Now that Netflix is involved, do they give you any feedback about your work? Do they give you, like, hey, we like this direction you're going, we hope that now that you have 2 more seasons to work with, plus this one, your third, that we would like to suggest, obviously you make the final call, but try this, try that, bring this type of character in?
None at all. I mean, and the great thing about the BBC as well, where the BBC you would think would be more likely to do that. The great gift to the BBC, since they've been around so long, is that they know when to say nothing and they know when to intervene. But the BBC are completely hands-off, and Netflix equally don't step in and don't make suggestions as to where it can go, which, for a writer, I consider my day job to be writing features, which is great, and I love it. But with features, it's so much more collaborative. You get so many more notes, and you get there in the end. But with TV, my experience with BBC and Netflix is that they leave you alone to do what you think is right, and then execute it, which is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. How is the reaction from people here in the United States to this series different from what you get locally in England? Are there certain elements of the program that the American audience really takes on as opposed to the British audience?
It's been strange, because I never thought that it would strike a chord in America in the way that it has, quite so spectacularly. And maybe it's because, I think, not even subconsciously but consciously, I wanted this to mythologize a period of history that I knew about. And I therefore sort of keyed into things like Westerns. I was very interested in the way that Americans are able to take if you think about a Western, it's 19th century agricultural laborers. And the Americans, without any hesitation, have turned that into legend. They've turned it into mythology. And it's wonderful, and the whole world responds to it. I tried to take some of that American boldness about one's own world, one's own, if you like, working class world, and be bold about it and say, yes, we can mythologize this. So maybe there is less of a reticence in the States for people to respond to something like that. But for me, the shock has been the breadth of the response. I mean, my example would be Snoop Dogg, who came to London and asked to meet me, and we met and we spent 3 hours together talking about his, how he responded to Peaky Blinders and how he felt that it spoke to his involvement in a gang culture. And for me, that was astonishing that, you know, this is England in the 1920s, and he's talking about Detroit and LA contemporary, that there would be resonance. But the people who have responded, you know, it's been quite overwhelming for me because a lot of them are my heroes. You know, David Bowie, Michael Mann, and Dennis Lehane have been in touch to say they love the show. And it's just quite astonishing to me that something that felt local when I wrote it can feel now so universal.
Mm-hmm. What did Bowie and Michael Mann and Lehane say about it? What moved them? And I understand that in the third season you do use some of David Bowie's music.
Yeah, I mean, Killian found out that he was a fan, and so Killian, at the end of the first season, the production gave Killian the cap that the character wears throughout the first season, and it was in a glass case. And when he learned about Bowie, he smashed the glass case and sent the cap to Bowie. And Bowie sent back a photograph of himself with razor blades sewn into the peak. And so suddenly we knew that there was a connection, and so we then got in touch with his people and said, would you be interested in us using some music? And they were instantly back to us saying yes, they would love it. So we had a dialogue that culminated so tragically just a few days before he passed on. But that's when we finally made the agreement that the music would be used. So yeah, I mean, it's been astonishing that people like that should respond to something like this. But you know, it's very heartening to know who amongst one's heroes are actually box set people.
Peaky Blinders, the critically acclaimed series on BBC Two and Netflix, begins its third season on Netflix this coming Tuesday, May 31st, at Netflix.com. And remember, Netflix is available on most smart TV sets, on most smart TV-making devices like Roku, Google Chromecast, Shield, etc., etc., etc. Stephen Knight is the creator and main writer of Peaky Blinders. He joins us live from London, and a radio exclusive interview this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Simon Appleman, we do live from New York. Happy you've made us part of your Memorial Day weekend. Hope you have a great and safe one. If you have a question or comment, you still have a chance to get it in at 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, SimonApple04. My name, welcome guests 462 and 482 into the room. Next Friday, our first episode of June will be coming your way one half hour earlier than normal, 2:30 Eastern, 5:30 Pacific time. And here's why. The executive producer of such critically acclaimed series as Nurse Jackie and Dexter, Clyde Phillips, will be my lead guest. He is executive producer of the new AMC series Feed the Beast, co-starring friend star David Schwimmer. It's produced here in New York by Lionsgate and makes its debut on AMC a week from Sunday, June 5th. But on June 3rd, he joins us live at 2:30 Eastern, 11:30 a.m. Pacific, exclusively on Tomorrow We Televise. Clyde Phillips with Feed the Beast. Now, here's a great, great show. Check it out and check us out when we from today, 2:30 Eastern, 11:30 a.m. Pacific, only on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. So what's coming up in Season 3? What can we look forward to?
The world comes to the gang rather than the gang going out into the world. It becomes a little bit more international. It gets much darker, I think. In Seasons 1 and 2, the family have made a lot of cash. They've made a lot of money. They're very rich. But one of the abiding questions of the series is a very British question, which is that, can people from this background, from the streets, ever attain what would be considered to be respectability? They can get money, but that's almost the easy part. Can they ever move up, as they say, in society? And the series is partly about that. It's also about the intense amount of pressure that is put upon the family by external forces who want them to do their bidding. So they get involved in an international arms deal that goes wrong.
Mm-hmm. Your series, Stephen, is the latest that has gotten a multiple season renewal, a 2 or 3 season renewal, in this case from BBC and Netflix. We're seeing more and more shows do that. About 10 years ago, when it was done for Damages and it was done for show or two, it was like the exception. Now it's becoming more and more the rule. And for a writer like yourself, Stephen, what kind of freedom does that give you in terms of how you plot out the future direction?
Well, it gives you space and it gives you you know, it gives you more flexibility because you know that your destination can be further ahead, the journey can be a little bit longer. I don't think it can, you know, one can't allow oneself to become indulgent where you think, well, okay, we're fine, so I can really experiment with this and that. And that's not the point, I think, of this exercise. The point of this exercise is more, please, you know, from the broadcaster, of course. Well, great, we will give you more, but it can't always be the same. But I think that what one must do is respond to the confidence of the broadcaster with a piece of work that is equally confident, but also be aware that you're not free to do whatever whatever you want. You have to be aware that the audience like this, so keep it going.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that I've heard from both sides of the Atlantic about why you're getting such popular feedback on the series, because this is a section of history that until you came along to do this series wasn't told. Hmm. With that in mind, do you feel more responsible about portraying it as accurately and as vividly as possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to be accurate to the spirit of the time, and I think you have to delve a little deeper, I think. In other words, what I try to do is tell the stories of people who have, their story hasn't been told. So, particularly in the UK, you know, history is told through the aristocracy, it's told through the royal family, it's told through one particular strata of society. I think it's very important to dig down and find the stories of some people, heroes and villains, who were living in effectively a different country to the one that you read about in history books, but do justice to them. And also, I find it very important that you don't look at the lives of the poor and the working class and the oppressed and all of that stuff and you know, ladle pity on that situation. Instead, see it as it really was and see these people as people who live glamorous lives, they live dangerous lives, they're intelligent people, they look after themselves. And I think that's the important thing, is to do justice to the spirit of the people you're portraying.
Peaky Blinders, season number 3, begins here in the United States on May 31st, this coming Tuesday, on Netflix. Remember, Netflix is available on most smart TV sets, as well as on most smart TV-making devices like Roku, Google Chromecast, Amazon Fire TV, and Shield. And the third season is already running on BBC Two in England, and I'm sure it'll be seen in other parts of the world as well. For more details about the program online, go to www.netflix.com. That's www.netflix.com. If you haven't seen Peaky Blinders yet, you are in for a great, great treat. And Julian Murphy's performance is among the best of any you'll find on television this year in the lead role of Tommy. Stephen Knight, creator and writer of Peaky Blinders, thank you again for taking part of your Friday night primetime to be with us. Congratulations on the success of the series, season 3 right now, the new two seasons coming up, and all the best for a great rest of your run.
Fantastic.
You guys, Stephen. Take care. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Stephen Knight, creator and writer of Peaky Blinders, joining us live, interview exclusive from London, England, where it is now past 8 p.m. local time. We've got a classic trivia question of the week, and we have a winner for you for this week's edition, and that's coming up after we talk a little bit about our wonderful sponsor, and that's Audible.com. If you love classic literature, Audible.com is a great way to hear it 24/7. For example, one of the newest titles you can find is Poems by Edgar Allan Poe, with a wonderful collection of great actors doing them. And if you're into Jane Austen, Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, we can check out the BBC Jane Austen Radio Collection with Benedict Cumberbatch and many, many more wonderful British actors and other people, too, involved. That's just two of the more than 180,000 titles available to you 24/7 at Audible.com. It's a leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment, information, and certainly inspiration. And the best thing is, you can listen to any Audible title on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio. Plus, if you sign up at this URL, audibletrial.com/televised, that's audibletrial.com/televised, you get one free audiobook and a 30-month trial of the service. And with Amazon.com running Audible, you know the customer service is top of the universe. So click on this URL and hear what you are missing with Audible.com. Audibletrial.com/televised. That's audibletrial.com/televised. When we come back, the winner of this week's classic trivia question will tell you what the answer is. And then you may get ready for less commercials, less commercial breaks, more show, and maybe a chance to interact with your favorite commercial messages that may all be coming up this fall. Is it something that will last beyond the fall? We'll ask Via Media CEO Mark Lieberman. He joins me live from Montauk, Long Island, after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You'll see the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com. More than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for Life Without Limits with Yogi Ruth. It's living life powerfully and living it to the max. Check out Life Without Limits with Yogi Roth every Wednesday, right here at various times on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, you get the best of BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to Marvin Tell Live for this Friday before the Memorial Day weekend. Simon Applebaum here with you live from New York here on Blog Talk Radio. Delighted to have you aboard. Thank you for making us part of your pre-Memorial Day holiday. We hope that once you get into it, it'll be a great and a safe one. 85 degrees at the top of the hour. And before we get to our next guest, let's hear the answer to this week's classic trivia question. And for the first time in a long while, we have a winner. And that winner is Judy Biondo from Sarasota, Florida. And for her correct answer, and first with it, she wins Make It Reality, Create Your Opportunity, Own Your Success, the new book by the CEO of Animal Shine North America, Chris Abrego, with a foreword by that wonderful musical artist, Pitbull. The question we posed on Monday was this. Complete the name of this 1950s television sitcom, Trouble with Blank. Trouble with Blank. The correct answer that Judy Biondo of Sarasota, Florida gave us, Father. Trouble with Father, also known as the Stu Irwin Show, was on ABC from 1950 to 1955, ran five seasons, was produced by Hal Roach Jr., the son of the great film and theater producer, and it starred the husband and wife team of Jane and Stu Irwin. And here's a little trivia question for you, one of the people that played their kids on Trouble with Father was none other than Sheila James, who later became the foil of Dobie Gillis, Dwayne Hickman, on his popular TV show in the late 1950s. So once again, the correct answer, Trouble with Father, ran on ABC from 1950 to 1955, starring Jane and Stu Irwin. It's sponsored by General Mills. By the way, if you go to YouTube.com, you can catch a number of their episodes. And we want to thank again Judy Biondo from Sarasota, Florida, for the winning answer, and the new book, Made in Reality, by Chris Abrego, followed by Pitbull, and published by Penguin Random House's Deliver Division, is on its way to you. We'll have a new classic trivia question for you on Tuesday's episode. That's right, we're not on Monday, it's Memorial Day weekend. We're on 24 hours later. Tuesday, same hour. We'll pose the question in the first half hour of the show. If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget to enclose your name and your mailing address. You can also use Facebook, which what Judy did, by the way, to come up with the answer. Or you can use this Twitter hashtag, @TWBT. That's #TWBT on Twitter. And that Twitter option is made available by the wonderful people at Hopscotch, the folks that invite you to create your own social soundtrack. Learn how at www.hopscotch.com. That's www.hopscotch.com. This is Bobby Televised. We have a program all about the tune. We'll be Mondays and Fridays, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you have a question or comment for our next guest, want to sound off on the world of TV no matter what, give us a ring, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You'll find it at blogtalkradio.com. Rebel, our friends in Philadelphia, now in the room, along with guests 408, 444, and 459. If you haven't read the TV news lately, here's something that might surprise you. We may be in for a fall season of less commercials, less commercial breaks, and interactive commercials on some of your favorite channels. Networks like TBS, TNT, True TV, Nasty Record Channel have decided we're going to cut back on our commercial time or our commercial breaks. Even NBC Saturday Night Live is going to take two commercial breaks out of its fall season. Why is that happening? And this could be the beginning of a new television era, a TV ad era that's also interactive. Joining us live from Montauk, Long Island, New York, the chief executive of a rep firm that sells advertising, Via Media, CEO Mark Lieberman. Mark, great to have you aboard.
Thanks for having me, Simon.
So, Mark, you've been in the thick of the news about what these networks are doing. First of all, do you think we are in for a new era of less commercials and less commercial breaks?
Well, certainly, Simon, as you pointed out, there will be less commercial breaks, less commercial load for sure, given the announcements coming out of Fox, NBC, and Turner. But what this means is that it's relevancy of the ads is going to actually be much more prevalent and critical, so that people aren't switching out because there's going to be a lot less advertising available.
One reason, a big reason why we are seeing these actions is because you now see that in prime time and in other parts of the day, 10 to 20 minutes out of every hour is commercials. It's promos. It's too many commercial breaks. It's too many ads in within the breaks. And it drives people crazy. And that is why some people think that's why Netflix and Hulu and Amazon, with their commercial or limited commercial free nature, is why they're taking hold and why they're now impacting TV viewing with lower ratings on broadcast and on some cable networks. Do you think this is going to be a one-season wonder, or do you think that we are truly in for a new era where the majority of networks are going to be lower in terms of the commercials they run or the breaks they run?
Well, I think that the networks are going to test it out, and I don't know whether it's a pivot in 2016, and that's what we're going to see for the future. But as you said, there's, I don't know if there's 20 minutes, but it's about 15 to 17 minutes. 15 minutes approximately is national ads, and about 2 minutes, 2 to 3 minutes is local advertising. But what it does do is it means that there's less inventory, which means that the prices will go up, simple supply and demand. But in order to compete not only with the over-the-top providers like Netflix and Hulu, but also compete with technology innovators online who are directing targeted advertising, is that that means that in those shrinking 15 minutes of advertising, that the advertiser is going to have to be much more relevant to the consumer. And a lot of those same networks that have announced less commercials have also announced more data-driven advertising, meaning that they're using the data to ensure that the commercials are much more relevant to the consumers that are watching their programs.
How is that going to show up starting this fall in what commercials we do see?
Well, one of the powerful aspects of cable, especially local cable, is the ability to do a couple things. One is on the local side is that you can do what's called geo-targeting, which means that instead of running the ad for the whole country, or instead of running the ad for an entire market, a whole what Nielsen calls a DMA, designated marketing area, is you can actually target the ad to effectively like a zip code or a couple zip codes. So if you are a local merchant or a local politician or even a national politician that wants to target a particular area of a county, you have the ability to do that with cable, and therefore arguably the ad's more relevant. But you can go beyond that, where you can actually attach other types of databases, purchase databases of what people are buying in that community, demographic databases, meaning what's the breakdown of the gender, the income level of people in that particular locality. And so you can start to get fairly narrow in terms of the kinds of ads that you have the ability to run. And then arguably what that means is that for the consumer, is that the ads are going to be much more relevant to what their likes and wants are, relevant to their community, which means that they're not going to switch away. They're willing to pay a higher price, and CPM as it's called, and therefore the advertising is going to be much more engaging than the old spray and pray methods.
So in other words, the advertising we could start seeing is going to be more relevant to our lifestyle. It's going to be more identifiable, if you will, with what people are going through either in their neighborhood, in their surrounding area, with their family, and so on.
Exactly. I mean, the classic story or the classic example is that if I own a dog and there's a pet food ad coming on for dogs, okay, that's relevant to my life. I've got a dog, and therefore I'm going to stay and watch that ad because I want to know what's healthy for my dog. If I don't have a dog and the ad's running in my household, the dog food ad, that's not relevant, so that means I may switch away while that ad's running and go to another network, another program.
Mm-hmm. Last week, when Turner showcased its fall season preview, showcasing the networks it has from Cartoon Network to CNN, TBS, TNT, Donna Special, who is their head of ad sales, basically went beyond what they were doing to say, hey, whole ad community, you've got to get behind this. You have to make this your number one priority. A, you've got to support what we're doing. You have to support what other people are doing. You can't just make it something for one season. You have to really make a fundamental transformation in your practices. You got to give us better commercials, and you have to really take it upon yourselves to take advantage of what you can do with these ad breaks, because this is like this may be your last chance to have your audience, because you'll get more of a say-so in the commercial time, plus the content creator will get more show to work with. Do you get a sense that the ad community as a whole is behind this? Are they going to get behind this, or are we going to see pockets of some networks will do it, some advertisers will do it, and everybody else is wait and see?
I think, first of all, Donna is a superstar, and bringing her over from MediaVest was a brilliant move by David Levy, because Donna, I know for a fact, when she was at MediaVest, was using data on behalf of some of the large advertisers that MediaVest had or has in order to come up with a more targeted approach for television. So using data is something that the agencies have been using for a while. The advertisers have been encouraging the agencies to do that. And just in the last couple of years, you've seen an adoption by all the major cable networks. The Viacom networks have made announcements, as has Fox, Turner, and of course NBC, of using that data. So I think it's going to be embraced by the agencies. What is interesting, Simon, though, is that the agencies, because they have been focused on data for a few years now, they'll have their own approach to data. And the networks will have their approach to data. Hopefully they'll be able to find common ground, because there's not really any currency around data yet, meaning that there's really no equivalent to Nielsen when it comes to data-driven advertising. Probably the closest is Rentrak, which was recently acquired by Comscore, which uses set-top box data, which is coming close to being a currency when it comes to how you actually buy and sell advertising in the new world of television, which is really data-driven.
Mm-hmm. And so we should point out that MediaVest is one of the top advertising agencies, buyers of advertising time in the advertising Madison Avenue world. We're speaking with the CEO of Via Media. That's Via, even though it's said V-I-A, not to be confused with Viacom. Via Media CEO Mark Lieberman. He joins us live from Montauk, Long Island, New York, this half hour right here on Tomorrow We Televise. Simon Applebaum, who's you live from New York. Delighted you're with us to kick off your Memorial Day weekend 2016 right here in New Haven, New York, where it's 85 degrees at the top of the hour. You have a question or comment for Mark, give it a ring at 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You'll find it at blogtalkradio.com. We want to welcome guest 521 and guest 529 into the room. If you missed the announcement earlier in our first half hour, next Friday we join you at a special time, 1 half hour earlier. It's going to be 2:30 Eastern, 11:30 a.m. Pacific time. And joining us as my lead guest will be the executive producer of AMC's new series, that's Feed the Beast, Clive Phillips. If you know the name, it's because he did for many years Nurse Jackie with the award-winning performance by Eddie Falco here in New York, and Dexter. Feed the Beast, incidentally, was produced here in New York by Lionsgate. It premieres 1 week from Sunday on AMC. Clive Phillips will be my lead guest. Also on the program, what are some of the shows coming up this summer and fall that should be on the radar screen? And how is diversity going to expand in the rest of this year? We've got one of our favorite guests, Linda Ahn, the president of Truth Company. She will join us as well. That is next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, here on Tomorrow We Televise. And we have a nice treat for you coming up the following Monday. Billy Ray Cyrus is coming back to television as not only the star, but the executive producer of a new dramedy on CMT called Still the King. We've got one of the key people working with him as both co-star, executive producer, and writer. Travis Nicholson will join me. That's a week from Monday, June 6th, right here, exclusively on Tomorrow We Televise. At our regular time, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. And many more great people coming your way in what is turning out to be a terrific month of original content in June. Mark, how is what's going on impacting what you're doing with your rep firm? How are you going to be transforming any practices or making any strategy changes to keep up with what's going on nationally?
Absolutely. In fact, what we do, just to give context, is that we run the advertising for 60 different cable companies across the country and about 3 million or so households throughout the United States. And an example of one of them is Google Fiber. Google Fiber is 1 gigabyte into people's homes in places like Kansas City and Provo and Austin. And we run the local advertising, that 2 minutes an hour that I referred to earlier, on behalf of Google. What's fascinating, though, is the ability to actually ensure that there's more relevant advertising in those Google Fiber households, because we're using the Google Fiber data, not Google data, but the Google Fiber data, what people are actually watching on their televisions. And then you're able to target down to the set-top box or down to the television a specific ad. What that means is that I could be watching the ball game in one room and my 15-year-old son can be watching the ball game in a different room, and we're getting two different ads. One might be relevant to my likes and wants, and one might be relevant to my son's likes and wants. So that's one example. Another example is we have what's called a programmatic trading platform for television. The way Wall Street works, of course, is it's all programmatic, computers talking to computers. It's rarely traders actually talking to each other. It's now computers talking to computers using data. The Internet works that same way, is computers talking to computers in order to come up with the right targeted advertisement that would be relevant to the consumer. Well, television is moving in that same direction. And we have a subsidiary called Place Media that's the fastest growing part of our business, where we're using data in an automated way to be able to target the ads onto cable networks throughout the entirety of the United States, 96 million households. And it's these kinds of initiatives which I think are not just riding the wave, but helping to drive the wave of change in ensuring that the ads that are being put on television programs are much more relevant with much more precision and much more targetability.
Stay with that process, because programmatic is a term that's really coming to play this past season in television. It's been around in the online world for a number of years. Explain how programmatic, which is an automated process when you boil it all down, how does that result in better or more relevant advertising that we see?
Yeah, so picture this. You're on your iPad and you're sitting down with an advertiser, and you ask that advertiser, what's your budget? What's your TV budget? $100,000 for the next couple weeks. All right, and what's the price that you're willing to pay? It's called the CPM. I'm willing to pay $15 CPM, cost per thousand. All right, now who are you trying to reach? Not what TV programs do you want to be on, but what kind of audience you're trying to reach? Well, I'm trying to reach women 25 to 34 years old who make $75,000 a year and own a luxury car. All right, so that's the demographic that you're trying to reach. You then press a button on your iPad, and it goes out and it actually finds the available inventory on all the different cable networks that are out there. And then if you say, okay, that looks good, that cross-section of cable networks looks good, you then press another button, and then you're able to basically make the buy, and then those ads appear on those cable networks that actually have a higher index or rating for that class of audience that you're trying to reach. Much more precise, much more targeted, a lot less waste, and the way you're doing that is because what's in the back end here is that you're able to aggregate up all the inventory from various cable networks that are part of this programmatic exchange. You're then overlaying that with data, set-top box data in terms of what's being watched, other types of databases, psychographic databases, purchaser graphic databases, and all that happens behind the scenes. So you're aggregating up the inventory. You're then using automation to make it an easier buying and selling process, and then you're going after a particular audience that you're trying to advertise to.
A few weeks ago, Hulu, which announced what they're doing at an event here in New York, gave us what may be the key to a very interesting story this coming year, and that is the idea of interactive advertising. For years, we've heard about what could happen if ads became interactive, that we could, from home, interact using our remote control, maybe our smartphone, maybe our tablet, to what is on the screen in a commercial or in advertising. And Hulu is going to start doing that this fall with some of their new series, in which you will see an ad, and if you want to respond to that ad, you will get immediately to the advertiser's webpage or to get a call to action, if you will. That, let's say you want a recipe or you want to order a product that you see in the ad itself, et cetera, you can do that. Is that being talked about a lot? Do you think that this fall we're going to see interactive advertising at least being experimented?
I think you'll see it being experimented, but I've been in, as you know, Simon, I've been in the TV business for 20 years or so, and there's always been the dream of, you know, the classic example is click on Jennifer Aniston's sweater, and then you can actually have the sweater delivered to your house in 2 days. The problem with that is that if you're watching a TV program with your family or your friends and you decide that you want that sweater, you've got to stop the TV program perhaps. You've got to click on it. The other people that are watching with you are getting a little frustrated. I don't know about you, but when I start to channel surf with my remote control, my wife gets upset. So can you imagine clicking on the ad and everyone else there sitting waiting for you to actually have that immersive experience? On the other hand, if it's a two-screen experience, which is that some sort of synchronization between your smartphone or your iPad and the screen, so you can go out, not interrupt the actual program or the ads that everyone else is watching at the same time, be able to go and deep dive and get that product, that could work. There's been attempts to do that. So no one has quite yet nailed what interactive advertising means on television. So I still think it's in the experimental stage. I think some companies might get there. They might find lightning in a bottle, but I don't think anybody's done that yet.
Last week, incidentally, at an event by a company called National Cine Media, one of the largest cinema advertising companies, they showcased what they're going to be doing this summer and fall with a company called TimePlay. It's a company that allows you, from your movie seat, to interact with commercial content, whether it's play a trivia game using your smartphone. At the same time, let's say a question is on the screen, you have the opportunity to answer it and maybe win a prize or keep score. Or you can see two people in a commercial, and the majority of people in the theater using their smartphone or tablet dictate who they see at any given time in the course of the commercial. And talking with the people at TimePlay, I found out that, yeah, they want to do that for television. At some point, they wanted to be a TV player. I don't know if you've heard of TimePlay, but I found what they were doing fascinating. And it's something that the TV industry might want to pay attention to.
Yeah, I as I said, I think the two-screen solution, so that you're using your smartphone as a way to engage, so that you're not interrupting the communal experience, because television is a communal experience most of the time. You're watching with somebody else. If it's just you, then you can go ahead and pause the commercial, pause the program, interact the way that you want to interact. But people don't yet watch television in that way. They watch it more as a communal experience. So if you're able to use the two-screen approach, I think that's interesting. If you're using the two-screen to actually impact what is up on the screen and it's doing it as a communal experience in the home, I think that could work. So I think the things that National Cine Media are doing with folks like TimePlay is a great way, because part of it is also affecting change by the consumer and how they interact with that big screen that's in your home, because for the past 40, 50 years, that big screen in the home has not been an interactive lean forward. It's usually a lean back. The lean forward experience is usually with your desktop, now with your iPad, but the television has really always been a lean back experience.
And this is exactly where smart TV set and device like Roku and Amazon Fire TV, Google Chromecast, et cetera, could play a role. Incidentally, TimePlay is going to install their interactive system in 500 theaters that are affiliated with National Cine Media by the end of the summer, 1,000 by the end of the year. In addition, they're also working with Screen Vision, the other major cinema advertising player, where they'll be in 1,000 theaters that Screen Vision has their pre-show events in, and that will be also by end of year. We're going to keep an eye on TimePlay. What they are doing could, again, have some very big consequences for the TV industry. Mark Lieberman, the chief executive of Via Media, joins us live from Long Island, Montreal, specifically right here on Tomorrow's Travel Live this half hour. Simon Applebaum with you from inside the New York metropolitan area. Happy to have you with us today on Blog Talk Radio. If you have a question or comment, we have a few more minutes with Mark, so get your call in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04, my name, and yes, we do have a call. Let's take it. Hello, you're on Tomorrow's Travel Live. What's your name and where you're calling from?
Hi, Simon. It's Rick Webb from Philadelphia.
Rick, go on with Mark Lieberman. You are on with him.
Hey, Mark. You talked a lot about targeting audiences in the last 10, 15 minutes. And one of my big gripes is that sometimes when you do get targeted, you end up seeing the same ad over and over and over again. So how do you think that this new paradigm may change advertising? Like, will they have to create a lot more ads or shorter ads or more entertaining ads? Like, how is it actually going to change the content?
Yeah, Rick, it's a great point, because there's other aspects both the agencies and the advertisers and the networks focus on, which is reach and frequency. Frequency, sometimes you see that same ad running and running and running, and yet the first couple of times it's relevant to you and it's funny and it's engaging, but then you see the same thing. And that same aspect applies in political advertising. And of course, political is hugely popular for cable. Cable is probably the most powerful medium, local cable, for political. So you don't want to see that same political ad running, running, running. And so it becomes really important if you actually have the information about the household, in an anonymous way to ensure that you can optimize the reach, meaning that you can reach the most number of people that are relevant to that particular advertisement, whether it's a brand advertisement or political advertising, and the frequency. Because, you know, picture a curve that goes up and then it goes back down again. As it goes up in terms of the number of times the ads run, very engaging, and you have great response from the consumer. But at some point in time, the curve goes back down again because the ads have run too many times. So now you're starting to turn off the consumer. So you can start using the old style reach and frequency approaches, but using data to become much more precise so that you're not turning off the consumers, which is, you said, is one of the major concerns.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot. I'm definitely going to be studying this a lot more as it, you know, as things keep changing. So thanks a lot. And thanks, Simon. Have a great weekend.
You too. Have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. Take care, Rick. Rick Weber, good friend from Philadelphia, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Perhaps the most interesting development, apart from this possible experimentation with interactive television, is what Crackle is going to do, which is a service that's available from Sony on many smart TV sets and smart TV devices, which is starting with the fall season, second season of their series, The Art of More with Dennis Quaid. They're going to have five commercials, just five commercials in every episode. And they will attempt to give each of those commercials for all 10 weeks, all 10 episodes, to one sponsor. So one sponsor gets 10 ads, one per show. And they'll also have the opportunity, if they'd like, to create additional material that can run with the show. Maybe get their product in a plot line. In some way, maybe a behind-the-scenes kind of thing. What do you think of that approach that Crackle is doing? And they hope that, by the way, this works with a lot more, that they will expand to some of their other originals.
I think it's interesting. I think it's clever. It reminds me, candidly, of the 1950s, where you had one sponsor for the television show. And I know you've reported on that, Simon. So I think it's a little bit of back to the future. However, I do think that it goes to even what Rick was saying before, which is to ensure that the ad that you're seeing from that same sponsor is different in every commercial break, still relevant to you, and perhaps it has an integration, what's called branded integration, so that the brand sponsor is relevant to the actual programming. I think there was Empire on Fox did this with Pepsi a few months ago. And it was very, very well received. And so I think that you're going to see more and more experimentation like that, where you're going to have sponsors take over entire TV shows, TV programs, but with different ads from that same sponsor. But again, it goes back to the same premise, which is it's got to be relevant, it's got to be engaging, so that you can actually have that precision marketing and have, make sure that you're talking to the right consumer at the right time.
We started this half hour with our classic trivia question answer, The Trouble with Father. If you see that program on YouTube, you will notice something very interesting. The commercials by General Mills and by other sponsors were on at the beginning and the end of the episode. The episode itself ran 26 minutes without a break. How times have changed. If you want more about Via Media, Mark's company, here's where you go online. It's www.viamedia.com. That's viamedia.com. It's www.viamedia, pronounced viamedia.com. I think you'll find what they're doing quite fascinating. Mark Lieberman is the chief executive of Via Media. Thank you for joining us, taking time out from wherever you are in Montauk, Long Island. Have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. We'd love to have you back. Maybe you talk political advertising, something we can get to this time around. And given we got a presidential election coming up, we would love to have you back maybe sometime around the fall.
Love to. Thanks for having me on, son. And have a great weekend.
You too. Pleasure all the way. Take care. Mark Lieberman, the chief executive of Via Media, joining us live from Montauk, Long Island, New York. When we come back, last week we introduced you to I Watch That, a possible way to get new television programs off the ground. Well, guess what? We have an up segment on it. Why? Because one program may have taken its first step with that venture. We will tell you all about it and a change, a possible change in I Watch That strategy. We'll get to that after we get to this, letting you know at the top of the hour, applause for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com. More than 25 million listeners around the world every month. And growing, listening to the best internet radio on the planet. It's your home for Movie Geeks United. If you love movies, you will love Movie Geeks United. Catch it every week right here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, you can find the best of BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com, and many of Blog Talk Radio's programs are available now in podcast form on the iTunes podcast app. If you have Apple TV 2.0, you can watch and hear Blog Talk Radio programs like ours right on the iTunes podcast app. If you don't have Apple TV 2.0, get it at your local Apple store or order it online. Welcome back for a few more minutes on Tomorrow Be Televised before we get you to get away for your Memorial Day weekend. Delighted you are with us. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. 85 degrees at the top of the hour. And now before we leave you, it's time for Up as an Update, where we update you on guests and topics we have on this program. And last week, just 7 days ago, we told you about an adventure called I Watch That. It's an online site where you get the chance to not only watch, but to comment on sizzle reels, 90-second to 2-minute possibilities for a potential new series created by all sorts of series creators. And if more people who watch and respond on that site like what they see, then the site, the sizzle reel in question, gets $25,000 to make a full-fledged 8 to 10-minute pilot, which is then marketed to broadcast cable networks the likes of Netflix, Hulu, and so on. Well, one of those sizzle reels that was shown was called Metro. It's by a writer-director named P.J. Posner, and it's all about the making of a 1960s magazine similar to Cosmopolitan. In fact, the sizzle reel has the actual editor of Cosmopolitan and the founder, Helen Gurley Brown, talking on various TV programs at the time, and in some cases being ridiculed for doing a unique women's magazine. Well, the response on I'd Watch That has been quite remarkable, so much so that 2 days ago, I Watched That announced on its site that 3311 Productions, a company headed by Rick Jacobson, he is a former person with Magical Elves, the Jane Lipset Danforth and Company, which creates shows like Project Runway and many other top shows you've seen on all sorts of networks from Lifetime to VH1, that they are actually going to take that sizzle reel and put that series, that potential series, into development, with Posner writing and directing the script and Jacobson producing. At the same time, on the site, and also explained in a Variety story that came out the day later, you'll find it in their digital section at Variety.com, the folks behind I Watch That, led by Tom Zito, the Fortune Washington Post writer, said that rather than give out $25,000 to a pilot, or any pilot that makes the grade, or sizzle reel that makes the grade, I should say, they're actually going to take some of those sizzle reels directly to independent production companies, broadcast, and cable networks based on the quality of feedback. So not all of these sizzle reels, if they succeed, will get that $25,000, and that is a change from the original strategy. On the website, the folks at I'd Watch That say that they are now in active conversations with other producers and networks about developing others of those sizzle reels. So once again, Metro is the first sizzle reel that is taking the next step through I'd Watch This, or I'd Watch That. Again, we have been trying to get the folks at I'd Watch That on this program, and because of whatever hostile situation, the public relations person who heads that venture up or represents that venture up, we're not able to get it. But I think it's very remarkable that, A, despite the fact that they've done very little publicity in terms of getting on our show or other places, they have given extensive interviews both to the Associated Press, Well Done Story, and now to Variety. So if you want to see that story that Variety did that came out yesterday, go to Variety.com. And once again, we are trying to get in touch now with both Posner and with Ross Jacobson at 3311 Productions. We'll keep you posted. We're keeping our fingers crossed that we can get either Posner and or Jacobson on this program to talk about Metro. And, of course, we'll follow for you no matter what how that does. We will also stay in touch with I Watch That's website. We'll keep track of what they're doing. And if any other sizzle reels also take that step to either become a full-fledged pilot or ultimately a series, we will invite the creators of those sizzle reels on this program. And we are still holding the door out for Tom Zito or his colleagues at I'd Watch That to join our program. And I hope at some point the publicist of that venture will have a change of heart. Why they don't want to be on this program, I have no clue. Again, as I said last week, I think it is more the bullheadedness of the publicist, we're not mentioning who that publicist is, by the way, but it's the bullheadedness of the publicist, not the company executives themselves, that's preventing them from being on this program. But we are holding the door open, and we will, of course, keep you informed once we get a breakthrough. If you haven't seen I've Watched That and you want to check it out, here's where you go online. It's www.iwtb.com. www.idwt.com. www.idwt.com. And I'd love to hear what you think of I've Watched That. So if you see that site, love to hear from you. So email me, SimonApple04@yahoo.com. Use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name, and you can also find me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter. I'd love to hear your reaction, and if you've used I'd Watch That, we'd love to hear from you. And again, we will keep you posted on what that site is up to. And congratulations to PJ Posner and Ross Jacobson for getting together through that site to create a pilot and maybe a television series out of Metro. I saw the sizzle reel. It's quite good, really well done, and I think it could be a really terrific period piece for television. Need to see what television network does pick it up. Again, we won't be with you Monday, where we normally would be because of Memorial Day weekend, but we will be with you 24 hours from Monday at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Tuesday. And joining us then will be Michael Hom, the Chief Executive Officer of Digital Media Rights and the former head of Imagination TV. Also, TechCrunch Senior Editor Anthony Ha will talk about where things are going with smart TV sets, smart TV devices, high dynamic range, and that technology's importance for television, ultra-high definition, virtual reality TV set, and a whole lot more. We had him on DK Live 2 weeks ago. I really think you'll enjoy him. And, of course, check out his work on TechCrunch.com. It's really outstanding. And once again, 1 week from today, we join you a half hour earlier than normal, 2:30 Eastern, 11:30 a.m. Pacific. 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 11:30 Pacific Time, we'll be joined by Clyde Phillips, the former executive producer of the award-winning Nurse Jackie and popular series Dexter. He's now doing Feed the Beast, producer in New York by Lionsgate. It premieres a week from Sunday, June 5th, on AMC. And we'll find out what TV shows coming up this summer and fall should be on your radar screen and where diversity is going to expand from here on the tube with one of our favorite guests, Lin Ong, the president of Truthco. And coming up a week from Monday on June 6th, one of our guests will be the co-star, executive producer and writer of CMT's new dramedy, Still the King, starring Billy Ray Cyrus, Travis Nicholson. And a whole lot more we've got planned for you as well as we sail into June right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. If you came in on today's episode late, or if you're a newcomer and you want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to our homepage, www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. That's www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. You can also check out our podcasts. They're available on iTunes.com. You can download us to your smartphone, tablet, anytime this Memorial Day weekend, and take us on the go wherever you're going on this holiday weekend. Share with your family and friends, and have them tune in live at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, Mondays and Fridays, sometime over the day, too, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, you can also get us now on the iTunes podcast app, available to Apple TV 2.0, where you can not only hear us, you can see us on your Apple TV television set using that wonderful device. If you haven't had Apple TV 2.0, you can order it online or go to an Apple store near you. We really love what you have to say about the world of television. What do you think about our guest today? What's your thoughts about where TV advertising should go this fall and beyond? Love to hear from you. So email me, SimonApple04@yahoo.com. That's SimonApple04@yahoo.com. Remember to enclose your name and where you're from. I do respond to emails in 24 hours. You can also find me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter and my own hashtag at UBCSimonTWBT. That's at UBCSimonTWBT. You can also find me here in New York on the Tube every Monday on BK Live. It's BRIC TV's daily talk show about culture, news, talk, all what great lifestyle here in Brooklyn beyond borders. It's on from noon to 1 Eastern Time on Rise and Fire throughout New York City, throughout Brooklyn on Time Warner Cable, Cable Systems, RCN. We do a Tomorrow Be Televised episode on Monday. And you can also catch that Tuesdays and beyond at youtube.com/BRICTV. That's youtube.com/BRICTV. Just like this show, we'll be with you with BRICTV's BK Live on Tuesday. And among other things, we will discuss Roots, the reboot of that classic miniseries of the 1970s that premieres Monday night on History, A&E, and Lifetime. It's getting sensational reviews. A lot of people think it's going to be a slam dunk for a lot of Emmy Awards this late summer. So we'll check out Roots on BK Live. That's noon on Tuesday right here on BRIC TV. You can also check out my Smart Televised columns. They're posted on MediaDoge.com, the wonderful media analysis and commentary site from our good friend, Jeff Myers. You can catch Jack's columns from our good friend Ed Martin of Planet Ed fame, Stuart Elliott of the New York Times, yours truly, and a whole lot more. That's MediaVillage.com, www.MediaVillage.com. Again, we love hearing from you, so please get involved. We love it when you communicate because when you do, what you say matters. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants, not necessarily those of Blog Talk Radio. Our production associates are Amy Domestico and Candace Williams. Amy Tillis, Blog Talk Radio's general manager, the creator and chief executive of this very enterprise, is Mr. Alan Levy. Tomorrow We Televise was brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Remember, you can get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televise. Audibletrial.com/televise. Audible.com, an Amazon company. For Tomorrow We Televise, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for your listening. Have a fantastic Memorial Day weekend. Please be safe and be great. And do, over the course of the weekend, not only treasure your family and friends, but take time out to honor and acknowledge the people who made the supreme sacrifice so that we could have the world that we generate. They and their families who live on after them would appreciate it very, very much. And so will we here at Blog Talk Radio. Again, thank you for listening. We'll be back with you on Tuesday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. You know where, Blog Talk Radio. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.